This Dharma talk was recorded live at the Austin Zen Center in Austin, Texas. If you enjoy these talks and wish to support the temple and its offerings, please visit austinzencenter.org. Thank you for listening.
Good morning to Zoom land and to the foyer folk. Foyer folk, I like that. For those of you who are not part of our retreat, which we just began last night, this is the first day of a seven-day winter retreat called Rohatsu. And many Buddhists around the world are sitting this week. It's usually considered and structured to be the most demanding of all the retreats that take place in a Zen temple. The longest, often the coldest, the darkest. And it leads to, most usually, to a celebration of the Buddha's enlightenment, traditionally on the 8th of December. And this year it lines up really well. We're ending our retreat on Friday the 8th, and on the morning of Saturday the 9th, we'll be having a ceremony and celebration, chanting the Heart Sutra in Japanese, the Daihishin Duran, the Makahanya Haramita Shingyo, to the drum, and whooping and hollering in celebration. And you're all invited. Zenshin, the Reverend Zenshin, is laughing. Maybe because when we do this in a certain monastery in the wilderness of California, we literally raise the roof on the building with the drum. The whole metal roof vibrates, and people are literally throwing confetti in the air and yelling and chanting all at once. So it's a great release of energy and of joy. We'll try to do it justice here. So the talk I want to give today on this is the first talk of this week. I plan to give four talks, and they're all circling around a theme and a teacher. So I'm going to say a few words about the logic of this, or the impulse for these four talks, to those of you who are just joining us for Sesshin. Today in particular, I want to tell some stories about one of our Chinese Zen ancestors, whom we know, because of the way we chant the ancestors' names, we know him as Sekito Kisen. We chanted the ancestors this morning, and we chanted his name. And in the practice period that we are concluding this week, for six of the 8 weeks, we have been studying especially his important poem called the Sandokai. That's the title in Japanese. And we chant that as the harmony of difference and equality. It's also known as the merging of difference and unity and other titles. And so this is a poem about the relative and the absolute and how they merge, how they harmonize. And it's a poem. So we've been reading the commentary by Suzuki Roshi, published posthumously, about now, I was shocked to realize, 25 years ago, and also a chapter in Living by Vow, the book by Okumura Roshi, his seventh chapter, which is on this text. And there are lots of other things written about this text in particular. It's in the standard Soto chant books, the Soto Zen chant books, and it's chanted very often in Zen temples. The other poem that Sekito Kisen wrote, which is called in Japanese the So'anka, or the Song of the Grass Roof Hut, or the Grass Roof Hermitage, isn't so much in the standard chant books, in the standard rotation, but it's also an important text, and we've been chanting it here for a few years regularly. Almost everybody loves it immediately upon hearing it. And I'm going to talk about that poem tomorrow, which I really hope to include in our study group, but there wasn't enough time. We had a lot to say about the merging of difference and equality. So I want to tell some stories about Sekito Kisen. And some of these I also wanted to talk about during our study group, but again, we didn't get to very many of them. So I'm going to tell them now. So Sekito Kisen, or Shito Jikuan, was born in the year 700 in the north of modern Guangdong province in China. And he lived not far from Shaoxi, which is where the sixth Chinese patriarch of Zen, so five successors actually, after Bodhidharma, who brought Zen from India to China, where he lived. And you might know Hui Neng as Daikan Eno. We chanted his name today too. That's his name in Japanese. So he lived and taught there. And our sources on all these ancestors are full of many stories about them and how they interacted with each other. And I'm telling you some of these, it's not so much an intellectual or academic exercise. It's that I think in hearing how they studied together, how they met together, how they struggled together with their teachers and with each other to understand Zen, to understand reality, is inspirational to us. They're human beings, just like us. And the more stories we hear about how they actually, you know, entangled their eyebrows with each other, which is a phrase, the more they become familiar to us. They feel like family. And it took me a long time to start really sorting them out, and figuring out who was who, which Chinese names were the same, were these Japanese names that we chant, who was whose disciple, who founded this, who went here, who went there. But the more you read these stories and you hear about them, the more you begin to kind of see how this school of Zen was formed and passed on to us. They truly are our ancestors. So, the sixth patriarch Hui Neng, or Daikan Eno. And in one of the sources, the transmission of the lamp, the Denko Roku, we hear that Sekito, I'm going to mostly use his Japanese name because it's easier for me to pronounce and it may be a little more familiar to you. Sekito, the author of our poems, we hear that before he came to practice, he stopped a local custom, which was to sacrifice oxen, which was done to appease various demons and spirits in the woods. Hunters were afraid of these demons and spirits, and so they sacrificed oxen and they offered libations of wine. So he stopped this as a young person, and he demolished the shrine where these sacrifices took place. And no one could prevent him from doing this. He did it over and over and over again. So that was one sign of his direction in life. And we also hear that Sekito, who had gone to practice as a young monk at the age of 13, was present at the death of the sixth ancestor, Hui Neng. Right? So a very, very young person, which is kind of typical of this period. He was already in a monastery, although he was not ordained by Hui Neng, the sixth ancestor, Daikan Eno. Later, about 15 years later, he was ordained as a monk in a place called Lofu Shan. Shan just means mountain, also in the same province. And then studied with Seigen Gyoshi, that's his Japanese name, who lived from 660 to 740. so he's sort of still roaming around his home province. And he received Dharma transmission from Seigen Gyoshi. So he is a third-generation master in the lineage that is descending from Hui Neng. And Hui Neng is, again, really important in our line, our ancestral line. So although he studied with Hui Neng, he didn't receive kind of approval or affirmation from him. He was too young and he didn't study long enough, but he's in Hui Neng's line. And in 742, so he's relatively young, Sekito moved to the province of Hunan to South Mountain, which is called Hengshan in Chinese. And he probably stayed there until he died, and he lived to be 90, so he had a long life. And in the course of this long life, he had many students and disciples, especially in the latter part of his career after he moved to South Mountain. I hate to call it a career, let's just call it his life. And three of the original five houses or five schools of Zen are descended from him, and that includes the one we're in. So one of his contemporaries in this area was Matsu, who lived from 709 to 788. So this is, you know, a story of kind of Dharma siblings, Dharma family. And Matsu was regarded, or is regarded, by some historians and scholars as the most influential Chinese Zen master of the 8th century. Right, so he's a biggie. And he also was on South Mountain. He studied there under the master and another student of the sixth ancestor, Nan Yue. So, right, there's this little cluster of folks all interacting around the sixth ancestor and all practicing in, you know, within spitting distance of each other. And from Matsu, the two remaining five houses originate. Right? So these guys are very important in terms of the transmission of Zen, and from Matsu we get Rinzai Zen. Right? So the two houses that now exist mostly and are practiced most widely, Soto and Rinzai, come from just these two. So according to the chronicles, Shito, or Sekito, and Matsu knew and respected each other and sent students back and forth to each other, right? Even though they ended up kind of, the line kind of diverges there in terms of Zen. And apparently they also enjoyed teasing each other from time to time. So here's a story. A student of Matsu's was leaving, and his master, Matsu, asked, "Where are you going?" And anytime you get a straightforward question from a Zen master, it usually leads somewhere not so straightforward or not so ordinary. The student said, "I'm going to Sekito's. I'm going to Shito's," right? Shito's, the guy who wrote our poems. Matsu said, "Sekito's road is slippery." And the student said, "Well, I'll carry a wooden staff with me. And when I encounter such places, slippery places, I'll be ready." And then he left. So the student gets to Sekito's place, and he circles the meditation platform, right? And he struck his staff on the floor and said, "What is the essential doctrine?" And Sekito said, "Blue heavens, blue heavens." And the student said nothing, but went back to Matsu and, you know, said, "Ha, this is what happened." So Matsu said, go back to Sekito and ask him again. Wait for his answer. And when he's answered, roar twice. So that was his instruction. So the student went back and he asked the question again of Sekito. And Sekito roared twice before the student could do anything. So the student goes back to Matsu again and reports this second encounter. And Matsu says, "Like I told you, Sekito's road is slippery." So I think this story, you can tell me what you think when we get to our discussion, I think this story shows us something of how two masters engage with each other, in this case through sending a student back and forth as a kind of emissary, and the way also that understanding and the intimacy of teachers and students is expressed in encounter, right? Not just by facing the wall and facing yourself by yourself, right? You can never really be by yourself, but especially in these kinds of encounters, and these encounters don't always end up with an expression in words. There might be a roar. So Sekito ends up with this new master, back to Sekito now, and his earlier life. He's with Seigen Gyoshi, and Seigen Gyoshi says to him, again, this is, sounds like a kind of random comment or question, says, "Someone says there's news from Lingnan." Sekito said, "Someone doesn't say there's news from Lingnan." Now, Lingnan is supposedly a reference to the so-called Southern School of Zen, or Sudden Enlightenment School, which goes back to Huainan also. So his master said, "Well, if so, if there's no news from there. If so, where did the sutras come from? Sekito said, they all came from this. Or maybe we might say, they all came from right here. Sagan approved that response. Now, according to our sources, the Sandokai, which we were studying and we've been chanting, it came about, the writing of this text came about because of a dream that Sekito had. So he has left his master, and he's taken up residency on South Mountain. And he has built a hut, a grass hut, at that place, which I'll talk about more tomorrow, as I said. And he's living kind of a hermit's life, or at least part-time he's a hermit. So he was reading a commentary on the sutras, and the commentary said, the one who realizes that the myriad things are one's own self is no different from the sages. And that struck him. That had a big impact on him. The one who realizes that the myriad things are one's own self is no different from the sages. And then Sekito, after eating, relaxed and took a nap and had a dream. He dreamed that he and his original teacher, the sixth ancestor, were on the back of a turtle, a big turtle, that was swimming in open water. Must have been a big turtle. And when he woke up, he interpreted the dream to mean that the turtle represented wisdom, and the water was the sea of existence. So he and his teacher were seated in wisdom and swimming in the ocean of being, or the absolute. And then he wrote the text of the Sandokai. That's the story. So this story and others come from the Denko Roku, the record of the transmission of the lamp or the light, which was composed by, compiled by Dogen's successor. Dogen is our medieval Japanese founder of Japanese Soto Zen. Keizan. Keizan is also honored as the co-founder of Japanese Soto Zen. So now we're talking the 13th century. We've leaped half a millennium. So he conveys the stories that we have of the awakening of Soto ancestors from, well, we call them Soto ancestors, but they start with the Buddha and they end with Dogen. So Keizan tells this story about Sekito and Seigen Gyoshi, and it's this story. Seigen raised his hosu, right, his whisk. You know the whisk that Zen teachers sometimes carry? It's a stick with horsehair, and it's a symbol of empowerment, a symbol of authority. So Seigen raised his whisk, holds it up, and he asks Sekito, does this exist at Saoshi? Again, this is where the sixth ancestor lived in practice. He's going back to their common important ancestor. And Sekito said, it's not only non-existent there, but it doesn't exist in India either. Kind of arrogant, you know? Right? So a hosu is often taken as a kind of pointer to reality, to indicate this, right? This, just this. And Keizan comments about this response of Sekito. It's not only non-existent there, but it's non-existent in India. He says, when this hosu is raised, how can you say that there is neither, that there is either a Saoshi or an India? This view is still only a verbal understanding of something external. So Sagan asked his disciple if he had been to India yet. Say it's not in India either. Well, have you been there? But, says the commentary, Sekito was unable to forget himself. He was unable to let go of his sense of self. We might call it small self. And so Sekito replied, well, if I went, it would exist. His master said, that's not good enough. Can you say more? But Sekito kind of punted. he asked his master to say half and not depend on him for the whole answer. And this is still not quite right. Right? This is, according to Kazan, this place is still reached by oneself, not by borrowing someone else's resources. Right? Didn't let him off the hook. Finally, the teacher told Sekito, I don't refuse to speak to you, but I am afraid that after this, no one will be deeply awakened. Kazan comments, even if someone speaks of pain or bitterness, if that person doesn't experience pain deep in his bones or experience bitterness ripping apart her tongue, she ultimately cannot understand the reality of it. You cannot get it through words. So Sekito comes up with a reply. Sekito says, it's not that no one will be deeply awakened, but no one will be able to express it. And here's that word that we've been talking about over the last few weeks. It keeps coming up. That is sometimes translated as able to say or able to express, dotoku, right? Ability to express something. Dogen writes a whole essay about this in his Shobogenzo. No one will be able to express it. So Sagan, this is the last part of this exchange, doesn't say anything. He takes the hosu, the pointer, to, as Kazan says, make him realize at once the existence of his own head. And he hits him. Realize his own true nature, not the small self, directly. And that's how he actually woke up. Sekito, according to this story, that's how he woke up, being hit by the whisk. And Kazan points to this story as an example, a kind of paradigm, of how to study the whole of understanding and true realization. And Kazan comments, lately, right, this is hundreds of years ago, y'all, lately, Zen people get lost in sounds and sights and search in seeing and hearing. See what I mean? Our predicament is really not new or different. Kazan says, even though they intone the Buddha's words, get mired in words on the road to liberation, they say that it does not exist in either Shaoxi or in India, and they still do not understand. So the story invites us to experience the whole body exposed alone, says Kazan. The whole body exposed alone. It is not to rely on others, even for half the answer. He says, where can you come and go? In this realm of vision, you will not wear the patched robe pointlessly. Right? The patched robe is the okeso or the rakusu. It's the robe of practice. Even more will you understand that it exists. It is thusness, or sometimes it's called suchness, things as it is. Even more you will understand that it exists when struck by the hosu, and quickly forget the self, the small self, and understand the true self. You will be alive in the midst of death, and in the dark, your eyes will be bright. Kazan says, this is the intimate reality beneath the patch robe. So I have just a little bit more. This is a different monk, Dao Wu, who practiced with three different Zen masters. He's also a very important figure in Tang Dynasty. But he was transmitted. He received approval by Sekito. So he ultimately was approved by Sekito. Dao Wu asks Sekito, who is a master now, who is it who has attained the essential principle of Shaoxi, right? Again, where the sixth ancestor in China practiced. Sekito said, the person who has comprehended the Buddha Dharma, right, and has attained the essential principle. So Dao Wu comes back and says, have you attained it? The essential principle, have you attained it? And Sekito said, no. I haven't. Dawu said, well, why not? Sekito said, because I can't comprehend the Buddha Dharma. Right? So he says, the person who has attained the essential principle is the one who has comprehended the Buddha Dharma. And Dawu says, well, what about you? And he says, well, no, I haven't attained the essential principle. Dawu, the student, asks, why not? And he says, because I can't comprehend the Buddha Dharma. Just hold on to that for a sec. Keizan records something Sekito said when entering the meditation hall and he spoke to the monks. So he is teaching his community. He walks in and he says, this body is Buddha. Mind, Buddha, beings, bodhi, defilement, the words are different. But mind is beyond annihilation and eternity, and its nature is beyond purity and impurity. Deep and complete, it is in sages and ordinary people. How can the reflection of the moon in water or the shapes reflected in a mirror originate or cease to be? If you can understand this, there is nothing you lack. This is just not to try to understand, but just to give you the flavor of this time and these teachers. I like this story. It's short. Some monk who doesn't have a name in our sources says, what it said to him, what is liberation? Sekito said, who has bound you? Another monk asked, what is the pure land? Sekito answered, who has polluted or who has defiled you? And a monk asked, what is nirvana? And Sekito asked, who has given you birth and death? And lastly, back to Dawu. Sekito was asked by Dawu, what is the great meaning of the Buddha Dharma? This is the Buddha Dharma that we hear in the other story. Sekito said, I don't understand. But here he answers him differently. He says, not knowing, not attaining. That's the great meaning of the Buddha Dharma. Dawu follows up and says, is there anything else? Please? Sekito said, the sky does not obstruct the white cloud's flight. And the final commentary in the Denko Roku, Keizan's Denko Roku, is, with one raising of the hosu, Sekito held up the totality of the way. Never by so much as a hair did Sekito ever deviate from it. So that's our guy. Do you have any questions or comments? Responses in words? Or roars. Maybe somebody wants to hit me. Yeah.
What's this Dharma transmission?
Oh, good question. It's what we call having your understanding confirmed by your teacher, who then says, now you can go teach others.
Okay.
And in this period, it usually means there's one person who is confirmed and you pass the Dharma to them, and they might inherit your temple and succeed you directly. But there's also often, or there can be, several successors, several approved teachers, and they go off and found their own places. But they're basically independent teachers. And in our lineage, they wear this color. So there's two other Roshis in the room right now. Ah. Oh. And they have various toys.
This is. They hit us too.
You get 30 blows if you say yes, and you 30 blows if you say no. So I just figure they cancel each other out. And we don't carry sticks and hit people anymore. But it's kind of fun to hear about it. It was a very physical practice. Intimate in many ways, including sometimes fist fights. So, I wouldn't want to take on most of you. Well, Do these, I have a question for you all, do these people with their, for many of us, names that are hard to pronounce and remember, do they feel like real people to you? Can you identify with their experience? Can you, do you feel any affinity with them? Yes?
Yes.
How do you feel it? Zen Xin?
The stories, the way they're told, the way you were telling them, the way they're passed to us, they make it alive. And to me, that's, it's affirmation, I guess. And it's just delightful to me that this practice, this tradition, is alive. It remains like stories from centuries ago. They're so vibrant, you know. It's a, oh yeah. And the Eiko Sōhotsu-man says, Buddhas and ancestors of all, whereas we in the future shall be Buddhas and ancestors. People. Wacky people. Just wanting to wake up. I can relate.
Yeah, the other line from that, Eihe Koso Hotsuganmo, the great vow of Zen ancestor Dogen, is revering Buddhas and ancestors, we are one Buddha and one ancestor. Right? So one reason why we chant all these names and we remember our ancestors, and now we call up the women who don't appear in these stories in quite this way, but they do show up, you know, they kind of come in through the side door and they sometimes best all the men. It's really great. Sometimes they don't even have names, but they like just totally upend, you know, these men. Sorry, guys. But they're there, right? They're there. So we chant their names, some of their names. But I think one of the most affecting little bits of what I read you to me again is Keizan comments about the encounter where Sekito's kind of asking his teacher, like, give me something, right? Give me half, right? He said, no, it's got to be you. But what Keizan says really strikes me. He says, even if someone speaks of pain or speaks of bitterness, if that person doesn't experience the pain deep in your bones, right, or bitterness ripping apart your tongue, right, you ultimately cannot understand the reality of it. So these stories point us to real people and their real experiences and their suffering, right? Why are we all here, right? Right? They too had the same experience. So you can't understand the reality of it. You can't get it in words, but the words are what we have to try to point in the right direction. So we struggle with words, and sometimes we shout, and sometimes we pound the podium, and sometimes other things happen. Yeah, Linda, Shinchi.
Many years ago when I was practicing closely with Sōjin Roshi at Berkeley Zen Center, there was an exchange between Sōjin and a student in the formal Shōsan ceremony. And I don't remember at all what the content of the exchange was. What I do remember was that I knew what it was about. It was in a very abbreviated, very Zen form, but it was referencing something that the student had been struggling with, and visibly with Sōjin Roshi. So it was like in five words, it pointed to this. And Sōjin's response went right to the heart of that. And I went, oh, this is what all of those moments are. Mm-hmm. You know, and I saw the exchange between them, the student bringing his pain and his confusion, and Sōjin Roshi with compassion, that this, you know, Manjushri sword of clarity just cutting right through it, you know, and the student letting go, you know, just having that visceral experience. I'm like, oh, this was like for me hearing recordings of jazz and not quite getting it, and then going to see live jazz. And I'm like, Oh, this is a conversation.
Yeah.
This is a dialogue.
Yeah.
This is alive. It's not just these random bits going around that have some secret meaning. I mean, there is, like, it's alive for them in that moment, and it's alive in a context,
and
we're trying to penetrate.
And it's improv,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's a bunch of improv, and that's what part of what makes it so alive. I mean, you can try to come up with somebody else's answer, right? You can read, you can look up and read and use so-called answers to koans, to these dialogues. And, you know, I haven't practiced with koans in that way, where I go in and try to present my understanding and get gonged out, you know, for years. But if you try to give somebody else's answer, you will definitely be seen through, I think. You know, it has to be you. You have to show up. I do think that what makes these things alive, even on a page, is that they're stories of encounters. That's how we understand in these dialogues, how it really becomes effective. You know, where awakening often happens is... And other people will often be witnesses. So like Shosan, the Shosan ceremony is like that. In that ceremony, for those of you who have not experienced it, the teacher sits in a chair, and it's usually the end of a session, and people, so we've all been together, you know, struggling, and everybody comes up and asks one question. It should be like a pithy question. Your question. And there's a response. And then the next person is right in front of the teacher, and there's another question and another response. So it's public. It's like public bullet dokusan, right? And it's very exposing for everybody, the teacher in the chair and the students who are witnessing. But it creates this sort of intimacy in which we all benefit. Sometimes there are tears. Sometimes there's pounding on the floor. I did see that. Someone who's now abbot, I saw that person pound the floor in front of Lyndon Root once. Yeah, all sorts of things. But I think the important thing is letting go of the self is also letting go, being willing to step forward into those moments and take a risk. Take a risk. We all take risks together, and we all experience together.
And it's also noticing how the teacher is fostering an experience and stepping back and not meddling too much, you know, allowing, I can't remember the name of the character, to visit the other teacher, not the slippery.
The slippery.
Yeah.
Go to slippery Sekito.
And so then there's this experiential process that unfolds between them, but without meddling too much. And creating enough room for the person to have their experience, and maybe blocking them.
I like that story because it's obvious that Matsu and Sekito know each other so well that they can kind of predict what the other one's going to do.
Yeah.
Why don't you shout? It's like, well, no, you don't even get a chance because the shout's coming from the other teacher. But the student gets to witness something in this too, right? Allows. These are not necessarily his questions, you know, all of his questions. He allows himself to be part of this dialogue and shaped by it, right? And just, I don't know how far apart these temples are, but, you know, back and forth, back and forth. Now what do I do? Now what do I do?
And in that way it kind of co-arises.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay. What?
I have another story.
Okay, tell us another story.
Dawu's brother.
Yeah.
Dharma brother, and also biological brother.
Yeah.
Yunyan,
yeah.
Yeah. And the story where Dawu is eavesdropping on his dokusan with Seiji Yoshi. And he's really anxious that his brother's just not getting it.
He's elder like, brother, younger brother.
He bites his finger so hard it bleeds. And, you know, I like that because maybe Yunyan wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he's our ancestor. It's Dumshan's teacher.
Yeah.
You know, so
right.
I find that quite encouraging.
There are no northern or southern ancestors, right? And also, between the dark, what is it, between the one translation, sharp and dull-witted, there's no distinction. Mm-hmm. Right? That's kind of a judgmental sounding way, but yeah, there's no being smart or being educated. And the sixth ancestor, in case you don't know, was illiterate. He couldn't read or write, and he bested everybody in the monastery and became the sixth ancestor. Mm-hmm. So, just you, just as you are. No one can do it except you.